Hey, welcome to Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. I'm Jason.
I'm Kevin.
I'm John.
And I'm Scott.
And we have a great show for you today. Let us know what's on the OR schedule for the day. Okay, well, today's day two of the Behind the Knife's live coverage of the 11th annual ASC meeting. Today we sit down with Dr. Dimick, who is the current president of the AAS, and with him we have Dr. Asegev, who is a very accomplished transplant surgeon. After that, we're going to talk about ED thoracotomies and mustaches with Dr. Gene Moore. And John, who else we got?
So we're going to finish out the podcast with Dr. Michael Zinner from Brigham Women's Hospital in Boston. And then finally, we have Dr. Kevin Stavely O'Carroll, also accomplished surgical oncologist and previous president of the AAS.
All right, well, Behind the Knife here back at the 11th annual ASC meeting. We're here with the president for the Association of the Academic Surgery, Justin Dimick. He's also the professor of surgery and chief of the Division of Minimally Invasive Surgery and the director for the Center of Healthcare Outcome and Policy. Dr. Dimick, thank you. Thank you very much for your assistance in getting us to this meeting. We've had a fantastic time covering the meeting, and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, guys. It's great to have you here. Your innovation in launching this podcast and featuring surgical speakers is impressive, and we're really happy to have you covering the meeting.
And we're lucky enough to have Dr. Dori Segev. He actually joined us on one of the first episodes at the American Transplant Society. He is a professor of surgery and epidemiology and the associate vice chair of surgery at Johns Hopkins. And more importantly, he's also known as DJ Dory, and he will be DJing at tonight's reception. And he's, like we like to mention, the fourth runner-up at the American Swing Dance Competition. So thank you, Dr. Segev, for joining us.
So Dr. Dimick, if you could just kind of reflect with us, you know, we're right in the middle of the meeting at this point, kind of your thoughts on how the meeting's going and maybe some reflections from your time as president and you know, why this association is so important and why it's so important that we're all here at this meeting.
Well, let's start with the meeting. I think the meeting is a tremendous success. It's been a lot of fun. It's had a vibrant atmosphere. Some thanks to Dr. Segev, DJ Dory for that, bringing some music into some of our sessions. But I think there's been an incredibly high level of science, a high level of participation from so many institutions. We set a new record this year for numbers. We're probably going to close in on 1,600, which is will beat Las Vegas' attendance last year by 100. And we've been growing about 100 registrants per year. And so you heard earlier in one of the sessions, Keith Lillimo, who is a former president of the SUS, our sister society, was talking about how during their reign, his presidential address was SUS-SOS because he thought those academic surgical societies were dying. And I think the fact that we have such a vibrant, growing meeting now is really exciting. It's really exciting for academic surgery. And I personally find it a great honor to serve for an organization that acts as a source of inspiration in a time that can be somewhat depressing when you look at NIH funding rates, et cetera. And so we like to convene a forum where people can come to be inspired and go back to their homes inspired to keep persisting through what can be sometimes a little bit of a tough slog.
Yeah, we can say we've never been to a meeting that quite embraces medical students and residents and junior faculty like that has been here, and it's been really fantastic, and especially by really top leaders in the field that come to this meeting, and that is their purpose. And Dr. Segev, actually, why do you come to the AAS?
So that's a good question, because most of my time is spent in transplant meetings. But for me, the AAS is, this meeting is a great opportunity to interact with the young people in our field and to celebrate the fact that today general surgery is not homogeneous. It's not, I mean, I remember when I was a resident, I was a little bit even afraid to talk about hobbies that I had, particularly if they were like musical hobbies. But today, you know, we know that you can be successful. You can be academically successful. You can be a great surgeon. You can be NIH funded. And you can also be creative and be sort of who you are. And it's great to sort of celebrate this atmosphere of people bringing in engineering into their research, people bringing in other creative endeavors into their clinical practice, into their research, reinvigorating education to make it more fun and more exciting. You know, it's sort of a new, funner surgery, and it's great to be a part of that.
Now, Dr. Segev, you're a very accomplished transplant surgeon and a prolific researcher. I have so many questions for you. But really, the top question I have is, how'd you get into DJing?
DJing helped pay the bills in college, actually. So DJing, I got into medicine long after I sort of pursued my passions for music. So the better question would be, why did you go into medicine? And that I'm still trying to answer.
Well, the next question I have is, what song would you pick for Dr. Dimmick, as I'm sure you've had before?
That's a tough one. I would probably pick the Humpty Dance.
For irony.
For irony. Just because of, for those of you who have not seen Dr. Dimmick on the dance floor, he sports one or two really, really classic moves from the 1980s. Unfortunately, he only sports one or two classic moves from the 1980s, but they're well worth doing, and they're well worth seeing, and he has the energy to continue this for hours at a time.
Well, hopefully we'll be seeing a little bit of that later tonight.
Unfortunately, my daughter's here, and she will not let me on the dance floor.
We actually just got out of a really fantastic session where top leaders from around the country came and talked about their failures and how they overcame these failures. And we're actually hoping to release that next week, and I think it'll be a really big hit on the podcast because so many people will be able to relate to this and get encouragement from this. Dr. Dimmick, I was just wondering, can you just tell us, why did you come up with that idea to have these top leaders talk about this?
It actually came, the impulse came from feedback from a medical student. So the AAS, one of the things we do, one of our key activities is to hold career development courses in conjunction with the American College of Surgeons. We do this annually. And we, for the first time a few years ago, asked for feedback. And I did that in the form of a blog post. So we solicited a young medical student from UCLA, who happened to be one of our committee members, to write a blog post. And his blog post was very poignant, very powerful, and basically talked about how the courses were more depressing than inspirational because we trotted out all these examples of great leaders and all the things that they've done, and we presented it as if they'd gone from step to step with kind of a flawless track record. And of course, that is not true. And anyone who knows these people knows it's not true. And they've had just as many, probably more failures than anyone else. Herb Chen, one of our past presidents, likes to say that Babe Ruth had the most home runs in his era. He also had the most strikeouts of any Major League Baseball player during that same time period. And Dory Segev, for instance, has the most grants of any surgeon in the United States right now. He also has had the most grants not discussed at NIH studies, actually. And there's, I think, a good parallel. So that was kind of the impulse and the inspiration. It was a medical student blog post, and we actually circulated among our leadership and had everyone read it, and we reflected on how we conducted the courses. The first reaction was, geez, that's crazy. It was awesome. We're awesome. Let's not listen to this medical student. But I think there's too much truth in there to ignore. And so we took it to heart, and we subsequently altered the design of our courses to start to bring in some of the unvarnished truth of what it means to be successful, which is not going from success to success without failure. It's going from failure to failure without loss of enthusiasm. That's Winston Churchill.
That's why they asked me to give the talk on resubmitting your NIH grant, because in the room I've resubmitted more NIH grants than any other human being.
Yes, that is true.
So what, looking forward, what's coming up for the next year? Where's the meeting next year? What's on the horizon?
So I think we'll continue with our core activities. Our core activities are this Academic Surgical Congress, which is a venue, growing venue for all kinds of science. We want it all. You do ethnography of disruptive physician behavior, we want that. You do basic basic science, we want that. Education research, we want that. Whatever you want to study, we want to see it presented here, and we want to be a home and a forum for that. So that the meeting, I think, will probably grow again next year. It's going to be in Las Vegas. Caprice Greenberg will be the president. That'll be a presidential year. It'll also be the 50th anniversary of the AAS meeting, so we'll celebrate that. And Caprice has a very interesting session planned to track down the history and how she has personally been mentored by a past president of the AAS from each decade of its existence. And so that'll be a panel of next year.
Now, you've always been an advocate for social media integration into the conference here today, and you've been pestering Dr. Segev about getting Twitter involved. How do you see social media playing a bigger role in the future? Is there any way we can integrate this more? That's obviously why we're here, too.
So let's. This is how I think about Twitter, and this is how I explain it to people. Because people think it's a way to. It's wasting time. It's what I just ate. And I don't see that at all. One of the reasons people come to meetings like this is because someone presents something, and then people line up with the mic to talk about it. And that happens once a year, and not everyone can be in that room, and not everyone can hear that talk. So it's a really limited way to get discourse around ideas. And Twitter is like that microphone at a conference that the world can stand at any time. And to me, that's really powerful. And I've seen that play out. And one of my favorite things is when you're at a meeting like this, and something is presented, and I'm moderating, and somebody tweets from the audience, and somebody who can't make it because they're in Australasia at a different conference poses a really interesting question, and I can bring that into conversation as a moderator. Like, that's the power of social media, is it connects us, and the more connected we are, the better our ideas are. So that's the power of social media.
Well, Dr. Dimmick, Dr. Sega, thank you so much for being with us today. Thank you so much for facilitating us being here. We've had a fantastic time. We're happy to be here. And for all the staff, residents, junior staff, fellows out there, start preparing your abstracts for next year because it's a great conference. Okay, welcome back. We're coming live from the ASC meeting. We're very honored to be sitting down with Dr. Gene Moore. He's been a guest on the show in the past, and we only have 10 or 15 minutes with him. I could spend 10 or 15 minutes just going over his accomplishments. He was recently, yesterday, awarded the SUS Lifetime Achievement Award, and believe it or not, this has not been his first Lifetime Achievement Award. He's the current editor of the Journal of Trauma and Acute Care Surgery. He was the chief of trauma at Denver General for 36 years and the chief of surgery for 28 years. He has been the recipient of multiple awards, multiple honorary fellowships, author of over 1,500 publications, and actually, what I'm coming to learn, the most interesting man alive. outside of the hospital, his interests include ultra marathons, endurance sports, mountaineering, skiing, and hunting elk. It's large elk. Dr. Moore, thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you all.
So, sir, you did just receive the Lifetime Achievement Award, and for our listeners out there that were unable to hear your address, I was hoping that you could highlight a few of the points that you gave to the audience.
Well, thank you. First of all, as I emphasized at the onset, this is not an award for any profound scientific contribution, but it really just recognizes a lifetime commitment of the ideals of the SUS. So I tried to emphasize three points. The first was burnout we hear about all the time. And I was suggesting that what burnout is simply is difficulty acknowledging our limitations and recognizing priorities. And ultimately, as I was suggesting yesterday, your family is your priority, and your family extends to your trainees and colleagues. Because ultimately, when you finish your career, what's most important is what you inspire them to do. And then as a corollary, then I addressed this issue about balanced life and acknowledge that certainly life outside the operating room is important. And as you pointed out, I've taken advantage of that in my life. But still, I would argue, for young surgical scientists, there's no escaping it. Academic surgery is hard work punctuated by hard play. And I think the hard play is an important part. I think you need to take out committed time and rid yourself of your electronics and really take time out. And then my final point was that things happen for a reason, and obviously this isn't true at all events in life, but professionally, I'd argue when you get a paper rejected, when you get a grant unfunded, or you don't get a job, or you don't get a position in an academic society, instead of getting defensive about that, you ought to take that internally and view it as an opportunity to improve. Because in general, those events occur for a reason. And so you can always look at something and improve it and take that as an opportunity rather than an adversity. So those are the three points I try to convey.
That was great, sir. One thing, you are the editor of the Journal of Trauma and Acute Care Surgery. And if I was a young assistant professor starting my trauma career, and I came up to you and I said, Dr. Moore, I want to start a research line. I want to, I'm at this university. We have some resources. Where are you guys hoping to see trauma research? Where are the greatest opportunities that you foresee in trauma research?
Well, that's a great question, and I asked that of Dr. Ben Eisman, who you probably recognize, a legend in trauma surgery, hired me at the Denver General in 1976. And I asked him almost exactly that question. And he said, well, Sonny, what you do is you sit down at M&M's with your little 3x5 card, and you keep writing down what the questions are that no one can answer how to solve it, and you do the same in ICU rounds. And frankly, that's how I got into coagulopathy 40 years ago, is that the patients with liver trauma were dying in the ICU. We got control, we had packed them, but they just bled to death. So I would suggest to young academic surgeons to look at the problems clinically that you see every day. And the ICU is a phenomenal research lab. Going rounds, and don't make it work rounds, make it research rounds. Listen when they ask questions and someone says, well, I don't know, or I don't think that's been looked at, write it down. Go back, get into PubMed, see who's worked on it, and then launch into that as a topic.
Well, that's excellent advice. Well, sorry, I don't want to take too much of your time. I know there's still lots of meeting to get to today, but we typically have a tips and tricks segment of our broadcast. And for you, you know, we have a lot of resonance learning, and one of the most kind of anxiety-producing things is, oh my God, what do I do if I need to do an ED thoracotomy? Can you walk us through a stepwise approach to how you approach, you know, that patient in the trauma bay?
I'll be happy to. First of all, I think the first thing is to be mentally prepared to do it. So when we have a trauma activation, which I'm sure is the same in any institution, the trauma surgeon is expected to be there before the patient arrives. And when I go into the ED and I hear the EMS call, we're losing pressure, or we're doing CPR, I look to our senior resident and say, okay, open the thoracotomy tray. Put your gloves on. Get your little betadine ready. This is you. You can't rely on anyone else to help you with this procedure. And when the patient comes in and they're doing CPR or we can't find a pulse, don't worry about intubating the patient. Don't worry about IV access. Get that chest open. So the first thing you do is you take that left arm and you elevate it above their head. And then you take the knife, and the incision starts on the opposite side of the sternum. Don't let the sternum and the cartilage get in your way. And you make this huge curvilinear incision into the axilla. Once you make that incision with the knife down to the ribs, and then take scissors. Don't use a knife beyond that, because people are going to be trying to help you, and you're going to cut somebody. But take those scissors and take huge bites into the intercostal space. And if you have resistance opening the chest when you put the retractor in, take the scissors and cut the cartilage. Now, if the patient has a wound in the opposite side of the chest, or if it's blunt trauma, either place a chest tube in the right side of the chest with some other individual, or simply take your hand and push it through the mediastinum into the opposite side to see if there's blood or air over there. But the key thing is to make a big incision, keep that arm up, then put the retractor in. And then the next key thing, of course, if they are in imminent arrest, is to open that pericardium, either to relieve blood or to initiate internal massage. And that's a little trickier than it sounds. You have to be careful with the pericardium. That is, if you use a knife, you don't cut into the myocardium. So you need to elevate that pericardium with some sharp instruments, usually sharp pickups, make a small nick, and then once you get in the pericardium, then take your scissors and open it. Obviously, you want to avoid the phrenic nerve, which is pretty obvious. But open the pericardium again widely. And if you need to do internal massage, make sure you do a bivalve with two hands. If you do a single hand and that myocardium becomes stiff, then you'll put that damn thumb right through the right ventricle. I've seen that many times. And it's embarrassing. Usually is not the final lethal blow because the patient's usually at that time they have these stone hearts or dead anyway. But for the individual doing that, it's very unsettling.
All right. Well, we would be. That was very good. That was very, very good. But we would be amiss if we let you go if we don't ask you one more question. So, anybody who has ever met Dr. Moore, he's well known for his magnificent mustache. So, how long have you had the mustache? Have you ever not had a mustache? And what's the maintenance like?
You should ask my wife these questions. Actually, she's always threatened if I came home inebriated, she'd cut my mustache off. And I must say, it's astounding. I still have it. I acquired my mustache in medical school. In general, everyone was well-behaved in college, so you got into medical school. Once you got into medical school, you figure, well, I got a maid now. I can be whatever I want. So many of us in medical school, I went to medical school at the University of Pittsburgh, were somewhat of rebels. So we all started growing hair. And I could never stand a beard. It was really too much. But a mustache fit in perfectly. So I think from my probably 6 weeks into medical school until now, I've had a mustache. And the care's not been very difficult. I usually bathe in a little beer every weekend, and that keeps it going.
Awesome, sir. Well, thank you for joining us, and enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thank you.
Okay, behind the knife here at the ASC 2016 meeting, we happen to run into Dr. Michael Zinner. He's the chairman of the Department of Surgery at Brigham and Women's Hospital. He's also the medical director of the Dana-Farber Brigham and Women's Cancer Center, and the executive director and founder of the Center for Surgery and Public Health. Dr. Zinner, thank you for being with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Looking forward to it.
So if you could, just for our listeners, just give us tell us a little bit about where you come from, where you trained, and how you got to where you are.
Well, I was born and grew up in Florida, in Miami, and went to University of Florida Medical School. And then, having never left the state of Florida, I thought I'd travel up north to what I thought was the north, which was Baltimore, to train. Little did I know that really wasn't the north. But I trained in surgery at Johns Hopkins. And then had a couple of jobs and ended up being the chief of surgery at UCLA in 1988. I was there for 6 years and then came to Boston in 1994, and have been chairman of the Department of Surgery since then, 1994.
And how long have you been part of the ASC, sir?
Well, that started in the I started with the AAS in the 1970s. When I was actually my 3-year commitment to the military was spent at Walter Reed at the Walter Reed Institute of Research, okay. And I joined the AAS in 1974. So I've been a member from, oh my gosh, since the very, very beginning. And I was privileged enough to work through the organization. I was president of the AAS and subsequently president of the SUS, too, during that early part of my career.
How does one become a member of the SUS? Or?
Well, that's changed over time. And back in the day when I was first joining the SUS, it was a sort of an elite organization. With limited numbers, you had to pass through a rigorous criteria for admission. There was limited to under the age of, gosh, I think it was 42 or 44. So, yeah, it was a pretty tight group. It was kind of why the AAS was founded, because it was designed to be just the opposite. It was designed not to be a restrictive group, not to be an elitist organization. And to have a broad base for all young aspiring academic surgeons. And the fact that they've come together over time is just a great tribute to leadership on both sides.
Great. Well, we were grabbing people quickly at this meeting, and we're trying to cover a real quick surgical topic, something that's in your kind of in your wheelhouse. I was wondering if you would mind, we could briefly discuss duodenal masses. So maybe some tips and tricks to how to deal with duodenal resection, either in the bulb for a benign mass, or and then for something maybe that's more malignant, that's a periampullary or in the second portion of the duodenum.
Well, fortunately, the periampullary workup now is pretty clear. Although we tend to get those patients from gastroenterologists after they've had much, much more workup than they actually need. Most of the time, what we need to know is sort of the characteristics, the imaging characteristics of the mass, and then see whether or not that mass is in fact potentially resectable. If it is, that'll be determined by what the imaging tells us around the vasculature. And once that's determined, it's pretty clear cut now about how we should approach those masses. When I started in training in the 1970s and 80s, Whipple resections had about a 25% mortality rate. I mean, that's horrible when you think back on it. But part of that was because we didn't know enough. We didn't know what not to operate on. And I remember doing operations with one of your former guests that lasted, 17 hours. And and let me just tell you, that was before there were self-retaining retractors. So standing on the back of the hooks for 17 hours was a real endurance.
Now, can you maybe go into a little detail how we've changed our practice with the duodenal mass that's, you know, invasion of the vasculature, as that we've gotten more aggressive with treating these cancers incorrectly in the past,
You know, that still remains a bit controversial in terms of whether or not there should be a vascular resection and the degree to which there should be a vascular resection. Mm-hmm. There have been various studies that have shown both ways, that, yes, even the very, very aggressive ones or very aggressive approaches end up with resectable lesions, but that's not a real question. The real question is, do we impact the ultimate outcome of the disease? And I think that's the question we need to ask. And some of the studies don't show that we've ultimately changed the outcome of the disease. We can resect more. We are able to take more patients to the operating room. But the question is, are we helping them? Are we really going to make a difference in their survival?
So last question on this topic. So a young female, a 2-centimeter mass in the bulb of the duodenum, it looks like a gist. How are you going to deal with that patient? How are you going to resect it? And how are you going to repair or close?
Well, it depends where in the duodenum. So there are parts of the duodenum that are fairly amenable to local resections. And then how do you reconstruct? And one of the ways, depending upon, again, where it is, if it's on the, if you will, the anti-mesenteric border of, let's say, the second or third portion of the duodenum, and you have a small lesion which you can resect and think you can get a margin, remember, that's all you have to do with a gist, is the options for repair include direct closure. Rarely can you do that. But one of the ways that that I've enjoyed taking care of those kinds of patients is using a serosal patch from either a roux limb or a limb of jejunum that comes up. That is a great viable way to close a big hole in the duodenum with very good tissue. And you do that in you can do that in a single layer or multiple layers running around that hole. And sure enough, you know, that's a lasting and durable way to do it. The other way, of course, is to just do an anastomosis in the same thing with that hole. So I leave that up to the practitioner as to which way they want to approach it.
So the one question we've been asking all our guests while we're here at the ASC, sir, is if you can go back on the first day of your internship, what advice would you give yourself?
I was scared out of my mind. I had come from a small school in a rural part of the country, Gainesville, Florida, 55 members of the class. I'd lived in a trailer and was driving a motorcycle, and I arrived in this big city in the heart of Baltimore. And I was just terrified. My only thoughts were, I just don't screw up. Just don't screw up. So my advice to the junior residents is, well, don't screw up. Listen to the people around you. Almost everybody's there. Almost everybody's there to help you. And for crying out loud, ask for help whenever you need it.
I have to ask, what kind of motorcycle are you driving?
Well, now go back. Now this is this is 1971. So I was driving a Triumph Bonneville.
I'm a Triumph driver myself.
Okay.
Rider myself.
Well, don't do that anymore.
Well, Dr. Zinner, thank you so much for being with us, and I hope you enjoyed the rest of the conference.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
So, welcome to all the listeners out there and behind the knife. We're very pleased to have Dr. Kevin Stavely O'Carroll, who is one of the leading cancer surgeons in the nation. He's a recent appointee for the chair of the University of Minnesota or Missouri School of Medicine, the Hugh E. Stevenson Jr. Department of Surgery, and director of MU's Ellis Fischel Cancer Center. Sir, welcome to Behind the Knife.
Thank you very much for having me. It's really a pleasure and a privilege.
So can you tell for all of our listeners out there a little bit about your background, where you grew up and where it came to the point, some of the major jobs that you had to the point where you're at in Missouri?
Sure. I'm from a small town in northeastern Oklahoma initially, Vinita, Oklahoma. And I grew up in Oklahoma, went away to undergrad at the University of Notre Dame, and then came back to the University of Oklahoma for med school. And interestingly enough, there'd been a couple of surgeons from Vinita that had gone from OU Med School to Johns Hopkins for residency. And that had a lot to do with why I ended up going to Johns Hopkins. And I did my training there for 10 years. I was in 90 and out in 2000, so pretty extended tour. And during that time, I did the general surgery training. I did a PhD in pharmacology and molecular biology and surgical oncology fellowship. And after that, I went to Penn State University, where I was for 12 years. And I was fortunate to build a big team there in hepatobiliary and foregut surgery, liver, pancreas, and foregut. That was our program. And we moved as a group to MUSC in Charleston, and we've just moved again to the University of Missouri. So I'm very fortunate to have a team. When I go to a new place, I bring my friends with me.
So, sir, a segment of our podcast is called the Dissection of the Day, and this is where we delve more in depth about a particular surgical topic. And since we have you with us today, we'd like to talk about GE junction tumors. So
absolutely.
Just start with the basics. If you could just walk to us, how do these patients typically present, and when you see them your first time in clinic, how do you go about starting the work up and approaching these patients?
So this is my favorite clinical topic because it's a challenging disease to manage, and it's also on the increase. It's increasing more than any other cancer other than melanoma, these GE junction tumors, and they're often associated with obesity and reflux disease. And the problem is they occur right at the interface where surgical oncologists and thoracic surgeons kind of overlap. And so something that I've always thought was really important is that whoever manages these tumors should be able to manage either a gastric cancer or an esophageal cancer, because a lot of times you don't know which it's going to be. These patients usually present with dysphagia, and then the workup is an EGD, which demonstrates a biopsy. And at that point, we get a PET CT. We stage them. When we think about cancer, the first thing we think about is the staging. And we stage them systemically. And for GE junction cancers, systemic staging is well done with a PET CT. And then as long as they don't have distant metastatic disease, now they're a candidate for cure. Surgery can be curative when it's integrated well with a multidisciplinary approach. Then we stage it further with an endoscopic ultrasound. They go down with a scope and they look from the inside out, and this will tell us the depth of the tumor and if there's any local lymph nodes that are positive. And that's important, because if it's full thickness or the lymph nodes are positive, you're going to want to give them some therapy before the surgery. It depends on where the location is. With the endoscopic ultrasound, these things have been classified. If it's a Seward type 1 tumor, it's more like an esophageal cancer. If it's a Seward 2, it's right at the interface, at the true GE junction. If it's a Seward type 3, it's more like a gastric cancer. And this can be very important, because if it's more like an esophageal cancer, we treat with chemotherapy and radiation first, and then we follow up with surgery. If it's more like a gastric cancer, we treat with chemotherapy first, and then we do surgery and we follow up with chemotherapy. Because even though these tumors occur right at the GE junction, we don't just take out the GE junction and then connect the stomach to the esophagus. That gives people reflux, and it's not really a good operation for cancer. So what we do is we decide, if it's more like an esophageal cancer, we take out the esophagus. If it's more like a gastric cancer, we take out the stomach. So they're two quite different operations. And if you're going to manage these, I think you should yourself be comfortable with either operation, or be part of a team that's comfortable with either operation. And team is really important with this. Really, my passion is the interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary care of cancer. Few places is it as well illustrated as with esophageal or gastric cancer. We have to work effectively as surgeons in a team of medical oncologists and radiation oncologists. So when these patients present and we find that they're resectable, but it's full thickness or it's gone to the lymph nodes, we'll treat them neoadjuvantly with chemotherapy. And we want that to be a process where not only is the tumor responding, but they're getting better prepared for surgery. So nutrition becomes quite important here. So part of our workup, we do a staging laparoscopy where we go in and make sure there's no metastatic disease that was undetected on the PET CT. And we put in a jejunal feeding tube at that time and a metaport, and then send the patient off for chemotherapy or chemotherapy and radiation, depending on where the tumor is. And when we give them a lot of consultation in the cancer center, that it's not only got to be the disciplines of chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery, but nutrition comes into play here and physical therapy. We like to prehabilitate these patients before surgery while they're getting their chemotherapy. So it's an exciting disease to manage. And then from a surgical standpoint, it's nice because, you know, sometimes you're operating in the chest and the neck. We take out the entire esophagus and bring the stomach up to the neck to make the connection. And sometimes you're in the abdomen. And sometimes we even take out the whole stomach and the whole esophagus, and we replace the esophagus with a colon interposition and replace the stomach with a bit of intestine, a Roux-en-Y. It's a fun disease to manage in the cancer center and as a surgeon.
Now, sir, you've mentioned the multidisciplinary approach, which, you know, a lot of cancer centers do, obviously. Now, what do you think in your practice is the most unique portion, or what do you think you guys do the best of that multidisciplinary approach?
Well, a lot of it is patient navigation. It's really important. A lot of these patients that come in with cancer are in their 70s, in their 80s. I mean, it is a disease that affects the elderly, and it's hard for them to manage our medical system. I mean, the medical system can be hard to manage even when you're well. But when you have cancer and you're undergoing chemotherapy, you're undergoing radiation, you're undergoing surgery, it can be really daunting. So what's really important is having a good system of navigation. So that's something that we've prided ourselves on at Ellis Fischel, is working with patients and navigating them well through that system. It's also important where we can make one-stop shopping occur whenever possible, where they can see the surgeon, the medical oncologist, the radiation oncologist, the nutrition therapists, and the physical therapists on the same day. And even palliative therapy can be very important. So all that's available in one-stop shopping in the cancer center. And we always present our patients at a multidisciplinary conference where we go through them as a team and decide what the best approach is. That way, we're not getting anyone's opinion in isolation. And a lot of time, there can be a vigorous dialogue between the radiation oncologist, the surgeon, the medical oncologist as to what the best approach is. And we come up with that approach as a multidisciplinary team.
So you mentioned the two different things in terms of some days you're doing an esophagectomy, other days you're doing a gastrectomy, a pull-up, and all the other things. You're standing at the scrub tank. Walk me through two different scenarios. I know you can't go through everything on this podcast, but you turn to your resident. These three are obviously residents, and I turn to my resident. And what tips and tricks do you give the resident in when you're dealing in these processes, saying, hey, we're going to do an esophagectomy today. Make sure you blank, or we're doing a gastrectomy today. We really want to focus for this tumor on blank. What are some tips and tricks on those technical aspects of dealing with this disease?
Well, what I think is really important is keeping your options open. When you have a big tumor that's at the GE junction, that's potentially curable, and you're going in for the operation, a lot of times you don't know if you're going to do an esophagectomy or a gastrectomy. And if you make a mistake, you can end up with someone that is not able to eat. They have a spit fistula. And I've seen patients suffer that are transferred to me. So it's important to keep your options open. So I never commit until I'm sure that I'm able to do the operation the other way. If we're going to do an extended gastrectomy where we take out the entire stomach and the distal esophagus, I usually make sure that I have the option of saving that stomach and doing a pull-up before I commit to removing it entirely. And similarly, if we're going to do an esophagectomy, I make sure that that's going to reach to the neck before I commit to that operation. So it's important to keep your options open. And there's always the fallback of taking out the whole stomach and the whole esophagus, in which case you want to make sure you've evaluated the colon very well. And in my experience, it's rare that the colon won't reach, but you have to evaluate it properly. And you can bring it up antiperistaltic or peristaltic. That's important to know, depending on where the blood supply is better, if it's from the IMA or the middle colonic.
Where do you guys generally in the chest, if you do a colonic interposition, is it retro sternal? Is it in the posterior mediastinum?
That's a great question. Well, I do it retrosternally, and I'll tell you why. The very first one of these that I did on my own, I had just a great pulse in the colon. It looked like it would reach the top of the person's head, and I put it in a condom bag and this elaborate thing to pull it through the posterior mediastinum. And I pulled it up into the neck, it reached great, but there was no pulse when I got it up into the neck, and because it was being constricted by the thoracic outlet. And now the clock is ticking, it's dying, and I went to pull it back down, and you know, it wasn't going to come. And if I pull too hard, it's going to tear, we're going to lose the blood supply, it's going to be a catastrophe. So I got out the orthopedic instruments and took out the medial portion of the clavicle and a bit of the sternum, and then it was able to pull back down. And at that point, it was almost trivial to establish a route substernally, because I'd already done a lot of that dissection. And from that point on, I've always done it substernally, although I hadn't seen it that way in my training or actually heard much about that way. So that's the way I like to do it. I'm sure there are surgeons that do it in the posterior mediastinum as well.
Could you just briefly walk us through your approach for different stages? So when you're initially staging that patient, you get the EUS and all that stuff.
Yes.
Are there patients that were using the endoscopic mucosal resection? Are there patients what patients would you choose for neoadjuvant therapy? And then for the patients that you operate on, can you talk briefly about things like margins and that type of thing?
Absolutely. So I think it's important to have a multidisciplinary clinic where you not only have the surgeons, the radiation oncologists, the medical oncologists, but also have the gastroenterologists involved. Because when you have carcinoma in situ or severe dysplasia, it's going to call for a lot of dialogue with the gastroenterologists and with the surgeons. And I'm a big fan of endomucosal resection for those opportunities, because you get the entire specimen and you can look at it pathologically. So if it's carcinoma in situ or there's severe dysplasia, that's what I recommend. I'm not as big a fan of the ablation, because I've seen patients where ablation was done where maybe it wasn't a good idea, and they come back instead of having a curable cancer, now they have a deadly cancer that has become incurable. So I think that has to be used with caution.
Can I stop you right there with
sure.
a question? And if you do the endoscopic mucosal resection for these patients that have severe dysplasia in the lower esophagus, are you wrapping them afterwards?
No, okay. No. I'm not normally doing that. We're just treating them medically. But I'll tell you one thing, after you have an endomucosal resection and then you have to do a surgery to do an esophagectomy, that can be a challenge, because now you've lost a lot of the integrity of the esophagus, and making sure you don't violate that when you're pulling on them can be tricky. But if the patient has more advanced disease, if it's either full thickness or nodes positive, when I talk to the medical students and the residents, I mean, we think of it much like we do rectal cancer. If it's full thickness or the nodes are positive, we recommend a neoadjuvant approach with chemotherapy and radiation. And if it's anything in between those, we recommend surgery directly. And I think it's important that this has changed. Initially, when a gastric pull-up was described, where we do the anastomosis in the neck, the advantage to that is if it leaks, it's got a much higher chance of leaking, but the advantage is if it does leak, it's not life-threatening, like a leak in the chest would be. But it was initially considered a palliative procedure where it wasn't a very good cancer operation. Now that these cancers often occur more distally, I don't think it's a palliative operation at all. I mean, we routinely get about 30 lymph nodes with these operations because we're able to open up the hiatus quite widely, skeletonize the aorta and that sort of thing. So these are very good cancer operations. And that's, you need 15 lymph nodes for staging. And I would argue for therapy, if you have someone that has, it probably doesn't matter if it's very early disease, it probably doesn't matter if it's very late disease, but if you're somewhere where you just have a few lymph nodes positive, it's a good idea to have a very aggressive lymphadenectomy.
I have one additional question about the neoadjuvant therapy. We know that the distal esophageal tumors you guys are, or we are treating with radiation and chemo.
That's right.
Excuse me, the proximal GE junction tumors of the stomach. Why are those not candidates for radiation? Is it too mobile? Is it?
Well, the problem is that if you're going to do an extended gastrectomy and a distal esophagectomy, now you're taking the distal esophagus and you're going to connect a long roux up to the esophagus. If you've irradiated that esophagus, that's not ideal to have an anastomosis. It's more or less in the chest with an irradiated esophagus. So that's what makes me reluctant to use that approach. The MAGIC trial demonstrates that preoperative and postoperative chemotherapy is quite effective. And so that's why when there's a more distal tumor, when it's really a proximal gastric cancer, I use chemotherapy without radiation. Now, if we do take out the entire stomach and the entire esophagus and we reconstruct with a substernal colon interposition, we leave clips in the posterior mediastinum and we can give a lot of radiation there postoperatively because there's nothing there to be irradiated anymore. So that's a nice way of doing it.
All right, so we're going to switch gears a little bit here and just ask you a little bit about liver bleeding. So if you're giving some tips and tricks to dealing with, you're doing a liver resection and you have a significant amount of bleeding, what's your process of going through there? What's the first steps you do it? And it's something we haven't touched on behind the knife before, so.
One thing that I think is really important for all surgeons to know about the liver, and particularly trauma surgeons, is how important it is to mobilize it if it's bleeding. And what I've seen cause trouble, and this is difficult to explain without really demonstrating it, but if you imagine you have a crack in the liver somewhere in the right lobe, extending from maybe segment 8 to segment 5, and you want to have a look at it, if you pull on segment 4, you're going to extend that crack. And that is, I've seen that happen and create real catastrophes. You want to have a look at it, you have to reach beyond the crack. And so you reach beyond it, you pull, now you're compressing the crack, which will cut down on your bleeding. Of course, you're going to put a Pringle maneuver on beforehand. But this gives you the opportunity to mobilize the liver. So if you have any bad bleeding in the liver, I think it's very important to stop the bleeding with a Pringle and a compression and then mobilize the liver. Because once you get the liver up, you know, out of the retroperitoneum where you can grab it, the part that's going to stay, you can often, you know, compress it, stop the bleeding with compression. I've even, you know, had situations where we quickly do the resection and then we just hold the cut surface of the liver with compression while we sew up the bleeding. So when you're in trouble, it's hard to solve a problem in a deep hole in the middle of a crack. But if you can get it up in the air and cut out that part of the liver, then you can sew the part that's left behind while you compress it.
So what are you using for your just, you know, straightforward standard liver resections? Are you using staplers, using energy devices, or are you fracturing?
Well, I was trained in the classical way where we would use a Kelly clamp and clips and then sutures and ties. I don't do it that way anymore. You know, I think it's important to be able to do it that way. I use the Aquamantis. It allows us to really carve things out very nicely from the liver. And if we're doing a resection, I come through with staplers, which definitely speeds things up.
And what about the end of that liver resection? It's a relatively large liver section, and you still have, like, frank bile leaking. What processes do you go through to solve that problem?
Well, a lot of compression and find out where it is and then oversew it. That's a good. That's pretty much all you can do at that point. But fortunately, that's rare.
Are there any topical type things, or do you sew omentum up there? I've seen some other people describe this thing, or fibrin glue has been used for everything.
I don't do any of that. So I'm not saying that it's not awesome. Maybe it is, but I just haven't got on board with that. So for me, I seal it with the Aquamantis, or I sew it. One of those things.
So that was some great tips and tricks on liver bleeding. So we're here at the 11th annual ASC meeting, and I was wondering if you could just talk to us a little bit about what this conference has meant to you throughout the years.
Well, you know, I got involved with the AAS early in my career. I was very fortunate. I became a counselor my first year as an attending. And that was just about the time when we were planning on combining the AAS and SUS into one meeting. And to see what has happened has been very gratifying to me. I mean, this is now a huge conference, and I'm hearing that there's, you know, more activity here than there is even at the American College of Surgeons. So I'm excited about that. And in particular, the AAS has had been a big part of my career, because I've never felt in any other surgical society that we would that I've ever had as much impact, or that we as a group have ever had as much impact. And I remember when I was very first getting involved, Perrin Cobb, we had this retreat where we would go and we'd lock ourselves in a room for 24 hours, it seemed like, and talk about the future of academic surgery. And Perrin Cobb stood up, and you know, he had the whiteboard there, and he was like, you know, right now, who are we at the AAS? He did a SWOT analysis, and he says, really, we're kind of rat surgeons, and you know, what do we want to be? And in that conversation, it came out, you know, we want to be about leadership and academic development for young academic surgeons. And over the next, ever since that time, it's 11 years now, that's happened. And to get to be a part of that, I mean, we established the leadership committee, we established the course on academic development, and those things have had such a profound impact on my career and on many other people on my team. I think it's great, and to see what's happened it makes me very happy.
Well, sir, we really appreciate all your insight, both into GE junction tumors, liver bleeding, and into the ASC. We've been asking all of our guests to close out with just one piece of advice that you'd give yourself if you could go back in time and talk to yourself on the first day of internship.
On the first day of internship, I think it's important. That's a great question. I think it's really important as an intern. And you can get kind of caught up on just being the best intern and writing down things. And the people that I've seen, and I really wasn't one of them, that got the most out of their residency really acted as if they were the primary doctor from day one. Like, okay, how am I going to manage this? I'm not just transmitting information upward, which you have to do, of course. So I'm not talking about being a cowboy, but I'm talking about going through the exercise. How would I manage this? And that's critical, because you learn so much more if you really put the effort. Pretend you're the only doctor. Pretend it's your board exam. You know, what are you going to do, and commit to it? And then present that to the person, and they'll tell you if it's all wrong, but you'll learn a lot more, and you'll be a better doctor as a result of it. And then a lot of times I see you know, people that think, if I'm not going to do the operation, if I'm not going to be the primary surgeon, I don't want to go to the operating room. I've got a lot of work to do on the floor and that sort of thing. And I think that's wrong. You get so much, even though you feel like you don't have a good view or that sort of thing, but you get so much education in the OR. So I think it's critical. That's in my residency now at the University of Missouri. I'm amazed, and I didn't have to implement this, but you know, the second or the third year always comes in, even when the chief is operating, and it'll be a very long case, and they stay the whole time, and they really get a lot out of it. So I think those are the two things. You know, get to the operating room, even if you're not going to operate, and always imagine that you're really the doctor.
Well, that's great advice. As one of my mentors used to say, independent thought, not independent action by interns. But we really cannot thank you enough for taking the time out. I know this is a big, busy Congress for you, and just giving your words of wisdom to our listeners of Behind the Knife. So thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. These are great questions. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Okay, that does it for us today on Behind the Knife. We enjoyed our day two at the ASC conference. We'll also be publishing another podcast for you tomorrow, highlighting the day's events of day three.